Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I am Jeremy Fisk, and as always, I am joined by Chapin Hemingway and Lee Carlo. We are going back to 1999 again in this week, and we're going to revisit M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong's Sixth Sense, a movie that I believe was second in the U.S. box office that year. Made a ton of money, and I think it only had like a $30 or $40 million budget.
Second internationally too.
It was second internationally too. There you go. Okay, and then we're gonna talk about twist endings on other movies, and then we're gonna finish it all up with Lee's rebuttal or maybe agreement with Chapin on Steven Spielberg's War Horse.
You know the accident up there?
Yeah.
Someone got hurt.
They did?
A lady. She broke her neck.
Oh, my God. But you can see her?
Yes.
Where is she?
Standing next to my window.
Shaking. Cole, what's wrong?
Did you ever talk to your mom about how things are?
I don't tell her things.
Why not?
Because she doesn't look at me like everybody else, and I don't want her to. I don't want her to know.
Know what?
I see dead people walking around like regular people.
I don't see anything. Are you sure they're there?
Sometimes you feel it inside, like you're falling down real fast. You ever feel the prickly things on the back of your neck?
Yes.
That's them. They get mad. It gets cold.
How often do you see them?
All the time. They're everywhere.
M. Night Shyamalan, since The Sixth Sense, has had, at best, a rocky career. He came out of the gate, at least critically, and the perception of him, strong with this movie. And then since then, he's kind of, you know, been a bit of a laughingstock with some of his movies, because he's tried so hard to recreate his sort of twist, his iconic twist endings. And a lot of times it gets clunky and it doesn't seem to resonate past what the ending is. Like, a lot of his movies just don't work on a sort of human level. So here we have The Sixth Sense, his absolute sort of biggest hit. And when going into this movie, I hadn't seen it since I saw it for the first time, and it wasn't in the theater. I saw it after that. It was probably around 2001 at the latest.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was trying to watch it this time, wondering how the hell he can pull this off. And just so everyone's aware, we're spoiling The Sixth Sense in this review. 20 years later, we're going to spoil it, because it's, if there's anything you can do with The Sixth Sense, it's spoil it if you haven't seen it. So if you haven't seen it, I would recommend you get in touch with, you know, the cultural phenomenon. But
well, Jeremy, I'm really surprised that you didn't see it when it came out, because as you said in your intro that we had to then cancel, it was the second biggest movie of 1999 after the Star Wars film, The Phantom Menace.
Yep.
The second internationally and domestically. It was a huge, huge, huge hit. $40 million budget, made $300 million domestic and another $300 and plus foreign. Biggest movie Bruce Willis has ever made. It was huge, huge hit. You know, we talked about like The Matrix being a breakout hit. This was really the breakout hit of 99, if we're really going to, you know, get down to it.
Right. And going into it initially, I actually didn't it didn't get spoiled for me. I mean, I heard the iconic line, I see dead people a bazillion times, which in a way
blew that in the trailer.
Yeah, which in a way is a spoiler, because that doesn't happen for an hour into the movie that you realize that this kid can see dead people. But anyhow, I guess the question I want to get to is, because Bruce Willis's character is dead the whole time and cannot interact with anyone else, watching it this time, I for the life of me wanted to know how he could pull this off, how that character could go through this movie and not notice how he wasn't dead, how he could interact with his wife, how he could interact with Cole's mom, how he could interact with Cole, how he could not figure it out. And then for me, I don't know about for you guys, this movie became about so much more and about other things. It became about the dynamic between those characters and the family dynamic between Toni Collette's character and Haley Joel Osment's character. And it became about the interaction between Bruce Willis and as Dr. Malcolm and Cole. So for you guys, watching this, knowing the ending, were you able to accept it and find something else in this movie that really works, or was it too much of a bother that you couldn't grasp it?
Well, I think one thing I did notice was that, I mean, of course, everybody will say this in retrospect, but it probably should have been obvious to people, and I wonder how many people actually knew
that was coming. It's so obvious the second time around, but it wasn't.
No,
it was
right.
Not obvious the first time.
And I remember that. I mean, I think it was a surprise to me as well, but it's almost, and so I think part of me thinks, had this been done maybe just a little bit, with a little bit more carefulness and thoughtfulness, maybe that would have held up a little bit better, that element. But that being said, I did find another element. And I think it's interesting, Jeremy, we missed you on the Midsommar podcast, but I do think I see a lot of echoes of what M. Night Shyamalan was trying to do in The Sixth Sense and in a lesser extent on Unbreakable and some of the later films that he did in Ari Aster's work, the idea of combining sort of really in a very connected way, family tragedy and sort of psychological issues with horror. Of course, at least in Midsommar, there wasn't really any supernatural elements like there are in The Sixth Sense and there were in Hereditary, but they're really, I think that's kind of how these two directors try to elevate their material, is by, making it really about the problems people have with each other,
I had a lot of things that I was sort of watching for and taking away from this movie this time around, and you touched on a couple of them, Jeremy, but first and foremost, and I think this is sort of always the case when you're watching a movie that has a very memorable twist, you're looking for the clues throughout the movie that allow that twist to make sense. And I thought that this movie did a pretty good job with that, and to the point where, yeah, it is kind of obvious. And I think Shyamalan was doing that intentionally. I think he wanted you to know after the fact that it was obvious and that
he
tricked
you.
And I think that's kind of the brilliance of this movie and something that he's been, after ever since and hasn't been able to get. I do think that he writes himself an out on what you were describing, Jeremy, about how Bruce Willis never know this. He writes, they don't know they're dead. They only see what they want to see. Boom.
Exactly.
Problem solved. Okay. But that's so simple, but it's also brilliant.
It works.
There's such a simplicity to this movie that I think works really, really well. And Chapin, you bring up Ari Aster. Part of his problem is the overcomplication of things.
Right.
And I think that these directors that are influenced by Shyamalan and specifically The Sixth Sense should pay attention to that simplicity. And that's what works because, this movie, I actually think Hereditary has a little bit more, not necessarily in its subject matter, but just in terms of the family dynamic to The Sixth Sense, because that is – kind of the pivotal piece of this movie, the relationship specifically between Haley Joel Osment, Cole, and his mother, played by Toni Collette. I think, you know, their relationship and their struggle to communicate and kind of understand each other is sort of like a surrogate for us as audience members in a way, because you can't really sympathize or relate to Bruce Willis in any way. I mean, he's boring as hell, and that's intentional, and I also don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but you don't really have a whole lot to latch onto with him. But with Toni Collette, like, you can understand her plight, and obviously you can understand this little kid of Cole being afraid, and I think those are things that are very easy to relate to, so you can follow that. And that family dynamic, again, in its simplicity, works really well. And that was some of the stuff that I took away. And I think knowing the twist and knowing everything that happens in this movie, you're allowed to pay more attention to that stuff. And it's refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the star of this show is those relationships and those performances in particular, especially Haley Joel Osment and Toni Collette. I mean, we look back on it like 20 years later, and if you hadn't rewatched it, you kind of just think of Haley Joel Osment as the kid from The Sixth Sense who says those famous lines and not much more. He is phenomenal.
How well he does it. Yeah.
He is so good. Your heart goes out to him so much. You want him to be rid of this issue that he's having. And he totally carries this movie in a way that any other casting might have made this thing seem silly. He's just so empathetic, and all you want to do is for him to be happy. You really do. And you're kind of just rooting for that, and you're rooting for the relationship between him and his mother to try to just bridge the boundary that they have that seems nearly impossible.
I disagree a little bit that the biggest takeaway for me, I mean, I guess I just saw it differently. Biggest takeaway for me was that those relationships, although I liked them, for me it was the filmmaking in this movie. And again, kind of simple, but long takes, you know, very patient, very slow, but it set the tone of this movie perfectly. And look, we've talked many times about horror movies and our reaction to them, and I've said, you know, I don't tend to get real scared in horror movies. I have like a very like clear memory of being pretty chilled by this movie, specifically the dead people and like Donnie Wahlberg, who I didn't know was Donnie Wahlberg until this time. Like, I have that picture of him in my head in his underwear, and it still to this day kind of chills me. And the kid with the gunshot wound in the back of his head, like all of that stuff really I found very chilling. And it's all about the way he just wear, like how he holds the camera on.
But a lot of it also is Haley Joel Osment's reaction to it and how
it
scared
is. And look,
he is.
And I'm not taking anything away from the performances or the relationships in this movie that I thought worked really well. But I sort of did marvel at how well Shyamalan shot this film, because it's not something that I've ever really given him a lot of credit for.
You know, you think of him, man.
And you think of his twists, you think of his, you know, downfall, I guess, for lack of a better description of his career. You don't think about the filmmaking. You know, you think about the screenplay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think his first four movies are gorgeous.
Look, I do too. I think they look good too. I mean, I don't remember. I mean, I know
The Village.
I like Unbreakable. I never saw The Village. As a matter of fact, I've seen Signs, Unbreakable, Sixth Sense, obviously, and The Happening. But I don't know that I've seen these other movies of his, because, you know, they just got destroyed critically, and I was like, okay, never mind. I mean, he's got more Metascores with the red background than the green background, which is never good. But yeah, I think there's a lot to take away here. But before... I know we haven't heard a lot from you yet, Chapin, but I will say, Jeremy, you pointed out how he's gotten real clunky with his later movies. There's evidence of that here too.
Really? Like yes. What? I'd love to know what you're...
I have an example.
Well, yeah. the Misha Barton storyline...
Exactly.
...is a big fucking mess. Like, what is that doing in this movie? Like, all of a sudden, it's a murder mystery?
It's awkward. It's like...
It turns into ghost town.
Yeah, he needed to figure out a way to connect... Like, once they figured out, oh, the ghosts need him for something, then... They were like, we need to figure out a way. What can we do to serve that? And it was the worst way. That was the
he
worst way.
He could have had her say,
that.
"I love you, Dad." Like she could have just said that, before in a video.
Instead of, but you think about it, like so. Then there's this random kid that comes into this funeral or after funeral, gives the dad a box with a video of the mom basically keeping the girl sick and dying. Like, where's the questioning of where did this kid come from? Why does he know that? It was clunky and it was kind of awful. And I don't know. It was a different movie than the rest of it, I guess.
I didn't mind that.
It took me so out of the movie.
You needed a solution to how he was going to wrap up. I mean, like, think about it.
It could have been anything else. It could have been, like, them just having a conversation with and figure... Like, it could have been anything where it didn't implicate a mother in killing her child.
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, if you buy into the conceit that these ghosts are... literally, it is the same plot as Ghost Town, where, like, they're sort of lingering in whatever this world is, in this sort of this limbo, waiting for something to change, and they're doing that for whatever reason, and so you know they need him to. I mean, there has to be something that happens in order for.
I get that, but I think it could have been almost anything else.
Yeah, it just felt like it took a leap that it didn't need to take. I mean, again, this movie. Is very streamlined and very patient, and then it just is such a conventional like plot point to introduce this murder mystery being solved because he can talk to dead people. I mean, I understand why it's there. I just think he chose the wrong storyline to do it. I also am curious about do you guys find this movie scary?
Parts of it, but I find it more emotional than scary this time around.
Chapin, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because I was thinking about our conversation last week, Chapin, with Midsommar, and how that movie, you know, we described it, and a lot of people are describing it as disturbing. And I don't know that this movie's disturbing, but I think it's chilling, and it has you kind of emotionally on edge. And granted, this movie was 20 years ago, but I'm wondering, like, is this... the more effective way to do, you know, the horror genre, to like just forget about trying to scare people, but just, you know, connect to people in a disturbing way, or you know what I mean?
Well, I think this movie is a perfect example of how to do a slow burn film about as well as you can do it.
Oh, because it's a slow burn for sure.
I mean, it is. It's a slow burn. It's really a movie for the first hour about this doctor who at the beginning, yes, gets shot, but most of it's him not talking to his wife, randomly talking to this kid about his life and trying to figure that out. I mean, this is like an hour of this going, and not in a bad way, but it's crawling. It's crawling. It's building to something, and it maintains an intrigue to it that I don't know, like it shows Shyamalan's skills.
You don't find it dull?
No, I don't find it dull because I think he's good. I think he did it well. I think it's a perfect example.
I can't decide.
Of it.
Like I feel like I agree with that, but I just even once you get to the I see dead people part, not much changes in the pacing of this movie, which is good. Like, there wasn't a shift.
No, it doesn't need to be.
No, but I still, like, kind of was teetering on the edge. I was like, what is keeping me engaged in this movie? And it, you know what I mean? And I was like, okay,
it's the filmmaking
is good, and the acting is good. I know there's a twist that is important, and it seems like all the pieces are in place for that twist to work. So, like, all of those things upon second viewing were working for me, so I was allowing this movie to be dull, but I was trying to think of this movie absent of that, which it's not, so I guess that's not fair, but I just felt like it is a little dull.
Well, I know what you mean. I mean, there's no... I guess why I was grateful for the Misha Barton subplot was because there's not... Like, where do you go from there? It's like, yeah, the kid sees dead people. Like, what can they do? Like, they have to... Right. Something has to happen. Something has to change. And so you finally understand that there's a purpose. Because, you know, like, once he reveals it, like, what is there to do? What is there left to do? And I mean, I don't honestly, like, I don't know that the Bruce Willis being a ghost is that important to the film. Like, we don't really, I mean, it is obviously it's like you go back and you look at it from a completely different point of view, but it's not quite as important as like the twist at the end of Unbreakable, right? Like a year later, he makes this movie, and I feel like that twist is so much more impactful to the fabric of the film than this one is. Whereas I think this movie is essentially Haley Joel Osment's story, and you know, it's not meaningless that he's a ghost, but it's
not pivotal, really.
But yeah, did you guys
I thought about
does
that.
He know does like does Haley Joel Osment know that?
No,
Bruce
I don't
Willis
think he does.
Is a ghost.
So there's so I don't remember when I heard this, but or I read this somewhere in a review of The Sixth Sense or a conversation about The Sixth Sense, and it was somewhere in the middle of these 20 years since it came out. So, you know, whatever, 10 years ago, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I heard something about when Bruce Willis first confronts him in the church, Haley Joel Osment like is frightened of him because he thinks that he's a ghost. And I looked for that, and I didn't see that. So I don't know, but there are some occasional like moments where you feel like Haley Joel Osment's on edge when Bruce Willis is around, but he's always on edge, so you can't.
Yeah,
pinpoint,
and he doesn't
get
cold really, like.
Right, but that's another piece that I think is actually really smart about this movie, and you see it more with Bruce Willis's wife, where you know she. "Quote unquote," talks to him, but she's right. Really just kind of talking to herself. She looks up at the waiter, but the waiter's standing behind Bruce Willis, so it looks like she's looking at him.
Right.
So, like, there's all these really kind of clever tricks that he uses that to keep you engaged in the idea that Bruce Willis is alive and well and just doesn't talk to his wife anymore.
Yeah. Going back to what you were saying at the end when he's in the play. Cole is talking to a woman who you're meant to think is like just another person, like a teacher,
right,
helping in the play, and it turns out she's a ghost as well, and he's not afraid of her, right? Like he's aware of what she is, but he's talking, yep, with her, and so he's not scared. I do think this is interesting, and I wonder if you guys think, I wonder if we can unpack this, or if it's even worth unpacking. But I did notice that when he is standing there, it's the last scene that they have that Bruce Willis and Cole have together. He tells him how to sort of reach his wife, talk to her while she's asleep. That all appears to be added in post. It all happens. Like with his back turned, I don't think they actually filmed that. So I wonder if there's any meaning behind that. You know, like it doesn't appear that was filmed. If that makes sense. In other words, like he says, "I know how you could talk to your wife," and his back is turned. You never see him saying that on screen.
Oh, I wonder if that was something he felt like he needed to add, because what I noticed after that scene is Bruce Willis goes back and he doesn't really talk to his wife while he sleeps. He says like one thing to her.
Right.
But it's not until she says, "Why did you leave Malcolm in his sleep?" And he's like, "I didn't." And then that was it. I was like, well, that doesn't count. That's not what he meant. He meant like, tell her you're sorry or whatever. And so, you know, I certainly hadn't thought of that, but I can sort of see that being the case, because that conversation that you would expect him to then go and have to kind of solve his, you know, marital issue, or really solve his kind of inner demons that he's having before he can peacefully die, isn't there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't notice that, but it's interesting that you brought it up, because structurally in the screenplay it makes perfect sense, because that's the help that he needs to give Bruce Willis. I mean, mm-hmm. that's why, I mean, we go back to that thing where M. Night Shyamalan writes himself an out. The out is that the ghosts don't only see what they want to see. So why does Bruce Willis keep showing up? Why does he show up at his school? Why does he show up, you know, at his play? How does he know about all this stuff?
How does he have his file?
Yeah, if nobody calls him, like, who, you know, all that stuff. Well, it's because he needs to have this resolution, and that's, he's attracted to this kid who can give him that, just like the rest of the ghosts are. So it makes sense to have that conversation where he gives him the information he needs to have that sort of closure. So I didn't notice the that it was filmed from behind and that maybe it was added in post, but I understand why it's there.
Yeah.
Two things that I think are just such a credit to the screenplay too with him is, and they both kind of, they both have to do with the Donnie Wahlberg character. One is how he manages to just make you forget that he got shot in, like, the possibility, and then this is a movie about ghosts, like, but you never think that first time through that he could be a ghost. Like, I don't know how he manages to just shoot that opening scene and then have you forget. But more importantly, what I think is really smart is the fact that Donnie Wahlberg character had the same affliction. It makes it seem so much more realistic that this kid could have it. It's not just this one-off, you know, freak kid, that this has happened before. Well, that's what they call him in the movie. That's his name. This exists. This has happened to people, and, you know, it's something that can just be diagnosed as a simple, mental illness that these children have. So I think that's really smart to do that, and to have that connection. And obviously they use that connection too to drive Bruce Willis to help him. But it allows you as an audience member to just accept the, you know, unrealistic aspect of this movie.
Yeah, watching it again, there's a couple scenes where I'm just like, how did anyone not know the first time? And the first one is, yes, he gets shot at the beginning of the movie. But I think what to Shyamalan's credit is at the, he doesn't reveal that this kid could see dead people for another hour, like I said. So they're interacting back and forth, and you don't even think about that at that point. You don't know that's a thing for an hour into the movie.
Sort of. They I wish so much they didn't blow that in the trailer. Like, that, like, this movie could have had two of the most iconic twists in the history of movies. Instead, they only allowed it to have one.
Yeah. And the other scene was when he says the "I see dead people's" thing, the camera is just like, when he says that thing about "I see dead people" and the ghosts only see what they want to see, it's like a zoom in on Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
And it's like, how is it?
I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
They're like,
not
like
more
this
obvious.
One.
Like, yes.
Yeah. I mean, overall, this is, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I feel like I've remembered The Sixth Sense fondly, but mostly for the twist and, you know, that it chilled me. But, like, this is such a well-made movie. I mean, I think it's very deserving of the credit that it's gotten over the years.
Yeah, it is one of those movies that goes kind of down in history for like the twist and, you know, the beginning of M. Night Shyamalan's career and then where his career ended up. But you kind of forget about the movie itself. And I definitely forgot about the performances. I had no idea, especially Haley Joel Osment and Toni Collette. Like, that
Toni
scene
Collette
the,
surprised me a ton.
That
this
scene
is her best
in the
work.
Car, the scene in the car at the end.
Yeah, that was really powerful.
Yeah, I was like, geez, that was a great, great scene and just a great performance by both of them.
So, I think this is Toni Collette's best performance.
It could be.
I want to ask you guys something. Do you guys think, so this movie was obviously a huge hit, as we stated in the intro. It was nominated for a bunch of Academy Awards, didn't win any, but still, it's a huge deal. And it was, you know, hugely, hugely popular. When it came out on video, it was hugely popular. So beyond the twist ending, like, you got to see this for the twist ending. In the days before, you know, Twitter and social media, where you could actually keep these things a secret, you know, let's put that aside. Do you guys would if you were shown this movie in 1999, would you think it was going to be the hit that it was? I mean, what is it in this movie beyond the twist that made it so popular? You know,
I don't know because. And it's funny that you bring that up, because when you were saying that you were surprised Jeremy didn't see this in the theater, that's kind of what I was thinking. I was like, because I don't remember this movie in 1999. Like, I remember the twist. But unless you're interested in horror or, like, there had to have been something else that drew people into this, because nobody knew who Shyamalan was at that point. And, yeah,
but
I mean,
you guys don't think this movie's engaging by itself. I think it's the perfect example of how to do a slow burn. This movie keeps you interested.
Nobody likes that type of movies.
Exactly. I totally agree. But you have to look at the other movies that came out that year. You know, it's like, you know, Star Wars and The Matrix. You know, these are these fast moving, you know, kind of new innovative movies, and you've got this like slow burn film that just breaks out. And I mean, I want to say that, because I agree with you, Jeremy, like, I think the filmmaking is very, very powerful here, but I want to believe that it's not just the twist ending that made it so popular. But I don't know that it is,
Chapin, because I mean, I think that we're not giving enough credit to, especially in 1999, before social media and everything like that, how powerful just the have
buzz.
You seen The Sixth Sense?
Yeah.
You have
Word
to see
mouth.
The Sixth
yeah.
Sense. Like, I don't think we're giving that enough credit. That had to have been such a big deal, because just imagine of the three of us, if one of us went to see this movie in 1999 and then said to the other one, you got to go see this. Like, we do that now anyway. And you told me to go see fucking War Horse again. And I went and watched it.
Well, I told you to go watch it for free on Netflix. I mean,
but
I didn't
that's
even
the,
really
but
tell
my point
you
is to, the same. My point is the same, though. Like, the word of mouth thing is powerful. And in 1999, that was how movies generated popularity. And I think a movie like this is...
No,
you
I
know,
got. Look, I gotcha. I know what you're saying. And I mean,
I would like to think that of the $672 million worldwide, that there had to have been something else. But I don't think that there is something else here for the broader audience.
But yeah. I think it's a universal. Like, it has a universal appeal, even
Bruce
if it
Willis
didn't
is
have
a star.
Even if it didn't have that twist, it is engaging throughout. You want to know what's going on. You want to know what's happening next. I think there's a lot to it. I just think the twist made it so that people are like, you have to see it.
Totally. And it's sort of a paint by number story. It's very simple. So that explains why people liked it.
But it's clever.
Totally
it's more
how
than
people
just
got
simple.
In the theater, though. I griped about how they spoiled the I See Dead People in the trailer, but this movie would not have made that much money if that wasn't in the trailer.
Sure.
So that's another piece, too, I think, that was maybe, you know, a smart money-making ploy.
I just thought of this, but what's interesting, I think, about Shyamalan at this time was that, like, I feel like the immediate comparison I thought of was, like, a Christopher Nolan, you know? Somebody who still can, you know, who makes really classy movies, you know, thinks a lot about how movies are made, is very careful and thoughtful about making films and about the films that he makes, and is an auteur in his own right, but also just knows how to make, like, knows how to market a movie, not just, and I don't mean, like, where to advertise it. I mean, like, how to construct the first trailer and then, mm-hmm. you know, how to make a movie that is just marketable in that same way, you know? And to me, I think that's, like, one of his both what makes him a genius, but I think also is one of his downfalls, you know, right? Like The Village is a movie that is, once you know the twist, is just almost completely meaningless. I mean, it's not quite, but it's one of those films where once you know the ending, it's like, why did I just watch this?
Right.
I think he started maybe believing a little bit too much in his own mythology.
Right. Got a little too Ari Aster.
Well, I think that's a whole conversation we could have, is where did he go wrong? Because, I mean, I think we all agree, I especially, you know, between The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, I think are great movies.
Signs is good. It's not great, but Signs is good.
Yeah, I think he just kind of slowly,
yeah,
I mean, goes downhill after. I mean, there's some peaks after that. There's some that kind of go up a little bit and go back down and up a little bit and then go back down. But really, it's
nothing goes back up after The Happening.
It's been bad.
It's sad. It's a real loss. And now he's kind of doing what he did, but like on a much smaller scale, I guess, or a little more in a little more sort of pulpy arena, right? Like, is that your guys' interpretation of like Split and Glass, those two films, which are, I guess, related to Unbreakable?
To me, that is him grasping at straws at this point.
Hmm.
You know, like Unbreakable was maybe his last, you know, not necessarily universally, but you know, mostly considered a quality movie. I think, you know, like I said, Signs isn't bad, and I think The Village has some fans. But you know, he looks back and says, okay, where did I go wrong? Finds Unbreakable and says, how can I build off of this? Because Unbreakable is left, you know, open for more. Sure. And I didn't see Split or Glass. I was not interested in Split at all until Glass came out, and I was curious, and I kind of still want to see both, but it might be a smart move for him to do that at this point.
Didn't they do well?
They did.
Yes. I guess what I think is interesting about is that it's almost as if he didn't believe in his own filmmaking, you know?
Do you think he relied too heavily on the crutch of a twist ending?
Well, you look
I think
at
he saw how successful that can be.
You look at his last, like, you look at his the films, like the four or five films after The Sixth Sense. I don't really know I don't remember what the twist was in Lady in the Water. Or The Happening, was it just like what The Happening was?
It was like something in the air or something. Yeah, it was stupid.
Right.
JP, we saw that at the Arclight. God, we loved going to that theater.
Jeez, it cost us $14 to see The Fucking Happening.
Good. It's at least we just were like, we have to go to the Arclight. Is there anything playing?
No, we actively wanted to see that because we knew it was bad. But I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, I think what surprised me, I mean, I guess I would say like I like Unbreakable better than The Sixth Sense. I really enjoy Unbreakable. It's one of my, I bet, like top 20 favorite films, but The Sixth Sense, I think, really demonstrates some really virtuoso filmmaking. I mean, I think there's a real, like, confident man, a confident director there. The movie he made before that made $282,000 in the theater. You know, it was a complete bomb. It wasn't, you know, there was no precedent for his skills. And then he comes out and he's got this big star and a rather sizable budget. And he makes this, you know, sort of slow, beautiful kind of, you know, artful film, and it makes all this money. And I mean, maybe he believed a little too heavily in the idea of the twist, because his next four or five movies, I mean, and you could argue that like almost everything he's done has got some kind of twist in it, and it's like, well, dude, you clearly have skill as a filmmaker.
Yeah, he as much as we all like Unbreakable, he would have been better off doing something totally different with his follow-up to Sixth Sense. Because I do think, I mean, the twist became synonymous with Shyamalan. Like, the Shyamalan twist is a thing that is, like, littered through pop culture, you know? So I think that's as much a crutch for him, like you said, as it is a skill of his. So, yeah, I mean, I think if he, you know, he did the Sixth Sense, and I think whether it was subconscious or not, he felt like he had to rely on that, and it's just little by little, whether you like Unbreakable more or not, like let's say since 2002 or 2003, you know, he's just little by little gotten away from the things that he does well and just relied on the thing that he felt like maybe made him all this money and made him successful and famous with The Sixth Sense.
Well, that being said, I think that kind of leads into our next discussion is, I've been thinking, like, what makes a good twist in a film these days? I mean, in a weird way, we've kind of seen it all. How do you surprise the audience anymore?
Yeah. Well, and this is what I wanted to ask you guys, because I was thinking about that. And Chapin, you brought this up a little bit about with The Sixth Sense, about like, what, you know, does Bruce Willis need to be a ghost in this movie, and how the twist is maybe more important to the character in Unbreakable. And I started thinking about movies, you know, with very iconic twists, and I was like, okay, well, like, how does this movie exist without it? So I was thinking about, of course, Usual Suspects. What if we take away that twist ending? Is that still a good movie, or is this movie rely too much on the twist? Is it defined by the twist? Or Fight Club? Or I even thought about a movie like Memento. You know,
all around the same time period too, which
yeah,
is
interesting.
Yeah, the '90s. Yeah, I mean Fight Club. Did I say Fight Club already?
You did. Yes. But Fight Club is a great example of, I think, like the Unbreakable one, where you do have to go back and. Here's what I would say the difference is. When you go back and look at The Sixth Sense, once you know the twist, you go and say, "Oh, that makes sense." You don't really look at scenes any differently. It just sort of makes sense to you, right? Like the emotions of the scene aren't really that different. But when you go back knowing the twist in Unbreakable and knowing the twist in Fight Club, it's a totally different emotion. It's a totally different sort of tenor of the scene, right? Like once you know that this is all like a manifestation of the narrator in Fight Club, it's like, oh, well, this is a totally different idea.
Well, you bring up the narrator, and I think that has a big part of it, because like The Usual Suspects, the whole thing is a narrator. It's just somebody making something up for you. And then once you realize it, that becomes the twist. And same thing with Fight Club in a weird way. Even though in Fight Club it actually happens, it happens in a different way. The narrator is driving that story. Whereas The Sixth Sense, I don't think there's necessarily a narrator, right?
No. This is just a narrative that we're...
No, I was just meaning the narrator is the name of Edward Norton's character in The Sixth Sense.
No, but I think that's a good point. Like, in the narrator in The Usual Suspects is Kevin Spacey's character.
Right.
I mean, that's what we're following. That's what we're watching.
So he can tell us anything he wants.
He can tell us whatever he wants. And the narrator in Fight Club is the narrator.
Remind me, what is real in... Is anything real in...
We don't know.
In the Usual Suspects?
Well, so that's why I brought that one up, because that one I think is interesting. And I love The Usual Suspects. I think we all like that movie, but... I was really thinking, I was just like, what is that movie? Like, take that twist out.
Exactly.
And like, what is that movie about? It's like a police procedural. It's like an hour long SVU show. Like, so that's what I think is really interesting about that one specifically, where these movies that are so defined by the twist, if you take it away, that movie is lost in oblivion. Like, it's gone. Yeah, it's
Fight
still
Club,
a good
I
movie.
I don't think it's that way.
I don't think Fight Club is that way. I mentioned a lot of movies just for the sake of discussion, but Usual Suspects is that way. The Sixth Sense, I don't know. It's bordering that for me, and Jeremy, I don't think it's that case for you. Another one that I wrote down, which I think is very similar to The Sixth Sense, is Blade Runner, because you have this much more foggy revelation at the end of Blade Runner that's similar to The Sixth Sense about who our main character really is. And that's an example, I think, of it doesn't matter. Like, that didn't need to be there. But it adds an additional element for you to think about after the movie ends.
Yeah, it's weird. Twists are weird because basically what you have to do to assure that a twist works is... present something to the audience, the whole movie, and then at the end, give them a good reason why everything you've just shown them is false in some way.
But it can't change the movie you saw, and that's the problem with twists sometimes. And we talked about it, another movie that came to mind was Tully, that has this twist at the end. And because of that, nothing made sense leading, like, in the movie. The movie didn't work. When you know
there
that
was
twist.
No real movie,
right? So,
but
that
you
can't
can say
happen.
That about The Usual Suspects.
You can, for sure, and that's why I think that one's such a fascinating study, because I think we still all like that movie despite the twist. And is it the acting? Is it the just the kind of the coolness of it? I don't know. But Christopher McQuarrie has made a career on his success because of that movie. And literally, all it really turns out, he had to write like two pages at the end.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to think what works as a twist, because a twist can't just be a shock. You know, it can't just be like, oh, this is what
surprise,
you
know, yeah,
surprise. It has to turn upside down the narrative that you've presented.
Should have done top five twists.
I suggested that.
Oh.
Yeah. And I just listed like five.
Chapin wasn't paying attention.
Yeah. I guess it's a little disingenuous is my problem. Or it can be, right?
It totally.
Yes.
Yep.
And when I have a problem with it in terms of like the mechanics of the filmmaking and like the minutes and minute filmmaking is when, you know, the director uses his tools as a filmmaker to make you think the wrong thing, you know, and it's like, why are you deliberately misleading me? That seems unfair. And I think, Roger Ebert, my guess is he had that same problem with, The Usual Suspects. He gave it one star, famously.
Yep.
And I think there's other movies like that where the ending completely changes your perception of the entire film, and he also didn't like it. And I kind of feel the same way. I mean, I like The Usual Suspects, you know, just kind of as like a exercise in screenplay, right? But I don't think it's a great movie. But
the screenplay piece is even more. Is it a great screenplay?
Well, it's just inventive. It's this idea that you know, is that the whole thing? I mean, is the whole thing laid out? Do we know? I thought there was a point where you know something. I can't really remember.
There's
not really
much there that like where you see scenes that you're like, oh, that could be Kevin Spacey. I mean, there's not a lot there. There's not clues throughout.
Yeah, they literally cast somebody else in his narration.
Yeah.
Wait, what do you mean?
Whoever they cast as Kaiser Soze.
Right.
They cast somebody else. So as like it is kind of cheap. Like, I wonder, maybe we should do a Usual Suspects retrospective, because talking about it makes me kind of angry.
You're like, this, what the fuck?
Like, well, why did we go for that?
I have a question for you, Chapin, because I know you've said before that you have issues with movies that end and you're like, it was all a dream, it wasn't real. Like,
sure.
So American Psycho does that to a certain extent in a twist fashion, but I believe you are a big fan of that movie.
It does do it, but I don't think that's the meaning. The meaning isn't, at least I never took the meaning as it's all a dream or it's all in his head.
Do you take the meaning that he really did all that?
Yeah.
Really?
The movie, when like the car blows up, the movie might suggest that it is part of his psychosis, you know, because there's all these things happen to him that scene in particular where he like shoots at a car and it explodes, you know, and he kind of looks at his gun like, you know, it's from Men in Black or something.
Right.
My thought, I think what at least the book was saying, and I think the film was saying, is also that, is that, you know, you, these guys are so alike and all, everybody's striving to be this one thing, and everybody's mistaking this person for that person because nobody has any uniqueness. They're all sort of homogenized that, you know, you could, it's like the perfect circumstances for a crime. You know, you are so just obsessed with looking this certain way and this and dressing this certain way that you can literally get away with murder because nobody knows who anybody is.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I was just curious about that one because I like that movie a lot until the end where it loses me for kind of that reason that I described, that I feel like it kind of takes this cheap way out and saying like, oh, just kidding. But
I mean, the film's sort of a the film, that scene is his lawyer. I think the scene you're talking about is when he confronts his lawyer.
Yeah, he says the lawyer guy's been saying, on vacation. Yeah,
right. He's been on vacation, and that he had dinner with Paul Allen in London 2 weeks ago. But he doesn't know who Patrick Bateman is. So why would he know who Paul Allen is, or whatever the character's name is?
There's something moving.
What the hell is it?
It looks like a cow. What the hell would a cow be doing out there?
That definitely isn't a cow.
Well, what is it?
It can't be a horse. Nothing alive could be out there.
It isn't a horse.
It isn't a horse.
Yes, it's a horse. It's a horse.
Yeah, it's a horse.
Well, bugger me. It's a horse.
Lads, we should call him.
What do you call a horse?
So a couple weeks ago on our Yesterday podcast, right?
Yesterday.
Yes, because it was Richard Curtis connection. Chapin brought up that he revisited the film War Horse by Steven Spielberg that we reviewed on the podcast back in 2011 or 2012. And if you listen to that old podcast and bear the poor audio quality on it, it was me, Chapin, and an old podcast friend Michael McCann just tearing that movie to shreds and really beating it down pretty hard. Chapin rewatched it recently as it is streaming on Netflix told us that he enjoyed it quite a bit.
I said I enjoyed it.
You enjoyed it. I think you admitted that it has some cheese and some flaws.
Absolutely.
But you enjoyed it. And he challenged Jeremy and I to go back and revisit this. It turns out, Jeremy, you've never seen it at all.
Well, I heard your podcast.
Because you listened to that podcast.
I
and why
to the
would
Get
you?
Your Film Fix podcast.
Yes, but I, of course, did see it, and I just hated it and never saw any reason to see it again until Chapin said this. So I watched it last night and then finished it up earlier today. And, you know, it's pretty good. I mean, look,
wow.
It's so fucking cheesy, and the scenes that really ham it up are terrible. Like the first half hour of this movie with Emily Watson and the main character and his drunk dad and plowing the field is so fucking dumb. And I was like, this is exactly what I remember, but then this movie goes on this like Benjamin Button / Forrest Gump horse journey that I think we criticized it for back in the day, but it was actually kind of interesting to kind of see it weave through all these different people and how the war was affecting like these different people around the world in France and in England and Germany, and I found that to be interesting to kind of not see it through the eyes of the horse, which whether this movie was trying to do that or not didn't matter. The horse was taking you into these different, you know, worlds and allowing you to experience it along with it. And I thought that was interesting. But again, then it kept coming back to this shit with the fucking horse. And like, why did everybody love the horse? Like this scene where they're like, they're going to shoot the horse.
This.
I did. It's pretty good. But it keeps coming back to this sentimental crap that I don't know why it needed to be in there. Like, this is Steven Spielberg making a war movie, the same guy that did Saving Private Ryan. And there's some, like, amazingly shot scenes in this movie. And there's some really interesting looks into how war can impact people. There's the best scene is these two German kids that take the horse and take the horses and go AWOL, and then they get found and just shot in the field, just like that, which you totally don't expect to happen. And it's kind of crazy, and it's an interesting scene. And so all this stuff works, but they keep coming back to this sentimental crap. They're going to kill the horse because his leg is cut, and then blind Albert comes back because, like, he whistled for his horse, and he's like, it's my horse. And then they all, like, say, no, wash him off. It is the horse he's talking about. He's just muddy. And they're like, oh, thank God we saved him. And I'm like, give me a fucking break. Like, why did they have that stuff in the movie?
Yeah. I don't know. I thought you liked this. What, now I have to defend it?
But okay, if you can defend that sentimental shit in this movie, then I will be interested to hear what you have to say, because I agree with you for the most part. This was way better than I remembered.
Look, the horse is covered in mud. It was in no man's land, wrapped up in barbed wire. And
who cares? So fucking the whole English army is like bleeding heart for him.
That's not what happened, Lee. A couple of guys were like, we feel bad for this horse. People have an attachment to animals. Maybe you don't, but lots of people do. And they said they wanted to help. And then somebody else came out and helped. And so a German came out and an English guy came out. And then they
that scene was kind of cool. The no man's land scene where they're. But I'm talking about when they get back. And
yeah,
they were going to shoot the horse, and then everybody's don't do it.
Because they know what the horse has been through. They know that they pulled it out of this miraculous situation, and it's okay.
Lee, are you heartless?
Ugh, God. That stuff I hated. But for the most part, I was like pretty engaged in this movie and was shocked and was like so pissed that I was going to have to come on this podcast and be like, Chapin, you were right.
I have to see War Horse now?
It's freaking gorgeous too, and it's
isn't it amazing what they do with that horse? It's just,
I don't know how they did some of that. How did they get that horse in the fucking barbed wire to begin with? Like,
it's all fake barbed wire, but yeah.
But like, they got that was amazing. Some of the stuff they got that horse to do. So yeah,
best actor.
Best horse.
Look, I mean, it's not. I guess the way I took away from it was that, you know, Spielberg has not been good in a long time, right? And I wouldn't say
Lincoln.
This is okay. Well, I know you're a big fan of that movie, but I am not.
Rewatched Lincoln, and that movie was not good.
Thank you. Snooze
why
alert.
Why would we like that movie so much when we all saw it back then?
I loved it.
And also, Jeremy, that was 2012. So Chapin's point about Spielberg not being good in a long time would still
stand. It's only 2019. Give him a few years. He's old.
He makes like 7 movies a year.
Well, no, he doesn't.
He doesn't direct
them. Well,
he's
attached to 7.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, go on, Chapin.
No, so that's just my point. And I think like he was always an idol for me when I was growing up. And it was nice to go back to a movie that, you know, I didn't really like when I first saw it because I couldn't see past that. Admittedly, the saccharine elements that are still there. But the way he just is able to... His control over the camera is just fascinating to me, and it's something that I admire so well. And it's not just, I mean, it is, you're right, it's beautiful, but it's not just that. It's like there's something about his control over the medium that is, I think, very, very admirable.
Bridge of Spies.
And I like that.
It was kind of fun seeing
that was some, after Lincoln.
See some of the, I did not like that movie. It was fun seeing some of the Avengers.
Right, yeah.
Loki and Doctor Strange teaming up.
There's got to be someone else in there.
That
too.
Scene that's I was looking to see if there were any more Avengers. I'm sure there were. But that scene I was talking about that was with everybody bleeding their heart for him, that was Sir Davos.
Right, yep. Davos is in there.
Yeah. So I just, I saw that he came on. I was like, Davos, everything's going to be okay. But yep. He was a dick.
Well,
no,
he wasn't Davos at the time.
All right. Should we tease this?
Yeah, let's try
idea?
It. Let's try it. Let's try all it. Right. We got 3 minutes till it's an hour.
So, we are admittedly, I feel like we're having a hard time coming up with top fives at this point because we want the top
five.
Well,
you never
want
to do mine, so let's start with that.
You never suggest any.
I do suggest them, and they're denied.
Yeah, on the podcast. when you say top five twists.
I just like doing top fives that like actually matter. Not like Lee likes to like the pithy ones that are like, who gives a shit? They're just like funny for a laugh.
So clearly the top five has been an issue amongst us in our friendship. So we're trying to remain friends. And we also want to try to keep, you know, interesting content for you guys. So we are welcome to email suggesting top five ideas and your thoughts on what we should do with that moving forward. But we also want to explore some new ideas for a different segment. So I was sort of thinking about this idea, and I don't know that we have it fully ironed out yet. So we'd also appreciate your emails at feedback@getyourfilmfixpodcast.com for some help with that. But the idea is somewhere along the lines of recasting the movie that we just reviewed. So in today's episode, The Sixth Sense. And I even think beyond recasting, you know, a different director or a different writer or a different cinematographer, if there is something that we feel like would be interesting, even if not better, with the movie that we just reviewed, we could discuss that. And not necessarily in list form like the top five, but just as kind of a fun discussion to have. We did a top five on recasting roles once, and I think we had some fun doing that. And one thing that did come to mind for me with this movie, The Sixth Sense, because Jeremy had said, you know, I wouldn't recast this movie, and neither would I. So I started thinking, I was like, okay, well, how else can we do this? And maybe it's not a discussion on who would be better, but kind of a what-if scenario. And this actor immediately came to mind in lieu of Haley Joel Osment. And I just started to think, what if Jake Lloyd, I don't know why I said Josh Lucas, Jake Lloyd of Star Wars A Phantom Menace fame was cast in this role?
He'd be terrible and it would have ruined the movie.
Right? Is that the end of the discussion?
That was your pitch?
No, but this is why I think this is an interesting discussion, because we talked on the Phantom Menace podcast about how they scoured the world over for an actor. And then here's Haley Joel Osment the same year that turns in this Oscar-nominated amazing performance in this movie, the second highest grossing movie of the year. And Jake Lloyd turns in this shitty, life-ruining performance in Phantom Menace. And I thought, like, well, what if these were, you know, what if the opposite were true? What if Haley Joel Osment were in Phantom Menace? I don't know. This is obviously a test trial run for this segment, but I feel like there was a discussion to be had.
Yeah,
here.
No, I think you're right. Well, here's what I would say. I mean, I think we always praise directors, but we don't always like lay into them when we should. And George Lucas deserves the criticism he's gotten for years for episode one, The Phantom Menace. I mean, I don't know why that documentary I sent you guys before we did the film showed him looking at the tape, and we saw the audition that Jake Lloyd did with Natalie Portman, and it wasn't any different than the day they shot that scene. And so George Lucas sat there and he watched that, and knowing the resources he poured into finding him, he said, that's the guy for me. And so, like,
It's like blaming a player for a coach's bad decision, putting him in a bad place.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, a player at least has like, you know, tried out and maybe will do, like Jake Lloyd is not an actor. I mean, he's just he had no business doing that. And it's terrible that he's now like, you know, bipolar because of how awful the experience was. I mean, but you have to give credit where credit's due. And I think like Shyamalan would never let Jake Lloyd be in this movie because he would know that he couldn't do it.
But here's I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit, because I don't disagree with you. But what has Haley Joel Osment done?
It doesn't matter.
This is my point. Like Jake Lloyd is not an actor because he sucked in Phantom Menace, and George Lucas can't direct actors and perhaps pick the wrong person. But maybe Shyamalan can work with actors, although The Happening would tell you otherwise. But maybe he can work with actors, or maybe he can work with child actors, and maybe he got something out of Haley Joel Osment that's never been gotten out of him since then. I mean, they tried to make him something. They did Pay It Forward. AI.
But you also got to...
But he disappeared. I mean...
He did, but...
He's good in AI.
Yeah, he's fine, yeah. But he disappeared. Like, he's...
But he's also a child actor, and I think there's a lot of baggage that comes with that.
There is.
Growing up and then trying to continue to be a good actor. I think there's a lot of baggage.
I'm wondering if, even if it wasn't as good, would we be looking at a different scenario if Jake Lloyd was the star of The Sixth Sense with a director that could work with him and get a performance out of him? Because look, they're practically the same age. They sort of have a similar look. Like, I just feel like it's...
All white boys look the same to you, don't they?
They do. All look the same. The possibility exists that, you know, like you said, Chapin, that the blame is due where blame is due, and George Lucas deserves the brunt of the blame for Phantom Menace, including the performances within it. And look, I am happy to praise Haley Joel Osment for his performance in The Sixth Sense, but should we give the director credit, and could he have gotten that out of somebody else?
Well, here's what I'll say. What if I've learned anything from the directing that I've done is that you're not an acting coach, you know? Like, that old adage that directing is 80% casting is really true. You hire people, you sit there for, at least for me, for a commercial for a day, but for a movie, you probably are sitting there for days and weeks, and you're looking at tape all the time, and you look at people, and you look at people, and you give them a little direction if they're in the room. But to be honest, like, casting, you got to find those people. It's not about, like, creating the performance on set.
Right. That's actually the wrong thing to do.
They own that character. That's them. And you're making little adjustments. Maybe you're, you know, as a director, you're trying to figure out how the camera relates to them, you know, adjustments in terms of how they're appearing on camera. But for the most part, you're not creating that performance on the day. That just wouldn't work. It would be exhausting. There's so many things to worry about. But also, when I give a piece of direction, I try to make it as simple as possible. You've got this person sitting there in front of lights, in front of cameras. There's like 20 people standing around. Their makeup is running, blah, blah, blah. They've got lines to remember. And you don't want to go in there being like, well, the complexity here, you really wanted to, you know, and spend 10 minutes talking to them about a 30-second commercial. It doesn't make any sense. You're just giving them a little bit of a nudge this way and that way. And in order to do that, you have to know that person can do the performance. And that's what casting is for.
So maybe the way to do this segment, and again, please send us your emails and let us know what you think, because ultimately this conversation is pointless, but it could be fun. Maybe the way to do it is each week one of us picks something that we would have changed about the movie, maybe not something that we would have changed, but something that we think would be interesting had it been different, whether it was the director, an actor, the cinematographer, and we discuss it much as like we just did with... Haley Joel Osment.
Or maybe it's like a gun to your head thing where you have to do, like, one of us has to pick it, and even if they agree or disagree, you have to change this one.
Yep. Yeah.
Part
I think that's a good idea.
I mean, think of this movie as being, I think Bruce Willis is really good in it, but you know, he's not as irreplaceable as Osment.
Exactly.
Is. Right. Yeah. So if you had to pick something, Bruce Willis
could be replaced in this.
Yeah.
Well, feedback at yourfilmfixpodcast.com.
Let us know what you think.
All right, guys, you ready to wrap this up?
Yeah, let's wrap it up.
I think we just kind of did.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for listening to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Next week, I think our next podcast is going to be Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, correct?
I believe
Hopefully. Just got to figure out how to see it.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right.
Real movie.
Yeah, here we go. Something new. I love it. So, tune in for that. Obviously, write us emails, feedback at yourfilmfixpodcast.com. Like us on Instagram. Just don't even look at Facebook, I guess. So until next time, we'll see ya.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.